south old front riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. We're reading again this week from The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days by Andy Adams. This book was published in Boston and New York by Houghton Mifflin and Company in 1903. The Log of a Cowboy is an autobiographical account of a five-month drive of 3,100 cattle from Brownsville, Texas to the Blackfeet Indian Agency in Montana in 1882 along the Great Western Cattle Trail. The cattle belonged to Don Lovell, the renowned cowman and drover, though he is not along for this drive, entrusting that responsibility to his experienced foreman, Jim Flood. Adams' log is a classic and authentic description of the trail men and their work, cow horses, and range cattle. Although strictly speaking the book is fiction, it is firmly based on Adams' personal experiences on the trail, and it is considered by many to be the best account of cowboy life in literature. So far in our story, Andy and his crew of cowpokes have brought their Circle Dot herd, assembled from numerous Mexican rancheros, across the Rio Grande, dealt with rustlers, struggled to contain two stampedes, negotiated with one group of Indians while avoiding others, labored through a perilous crossing of the quicksand-prone south branch of the Canadian River in Oklahoma, and barely survived a couple of nights and days of carousing in the wide-open cattle town of Dodge City, Kansas. The drive north from Dodge went well until they encountered the impassable slough of Big Boggy Creek just below the Solomon River. Working with cowhands from two other drives, they constructed a timber and sod bridge over which 9,000 cattle are driven over a two-day period. Once on their way to Oglala, Nebraska, they encountered a seemingly guileless old Kentuckian who managed to convince the boys to bet enthusiastically on a race between one of their speedy cow horses and his apparent old nag, a bet that they lose. After being relieved of all of their money, some of their saddles, and most of their watches and six-shooters, the crew sheepishly moved on to the wicked and rowdy trail town of Oglala. Here their fortunes turned, as Andy's bunkmate, the Rebel, manages to win a large amount of money at the Monte tables, which he shares among his comrades. They are now moving northwest again. I remind you that our stories are usually edited for recording. It was now July. We had taken on new supplies at Oglala, and a week afterwards, the herd was snailing along the North Platte on its way to the land of the Blackfeet. It was always hard to get a herd past a supply point. We'd experienced the same trouble when we passed Dodge. Our long hours in the saddle, coupled with the monotony of our work, made those supply points of such interest to us that they were like oases in desert lands to devotees on pilgrimage to some consecrated shrine. We could have spent a week in Oglala and enjoyed our visit every blessed moment of the time. But now, a week later, most of the headaches had disappeared, and we had settled down to our daily work. At Horse Creek, the last stream of water before entering Wyoming, a lad who cut the trail at that point for some cattle companies, after trimming us up, rode along for half a day through their range and told us of an accident which happened about a week before. The horse of some peeler, working with one of Shanghai Pierce's herds, acted up one morning and fell backward with him so that his gun accidentally discharged. The outfit lay over a day and gave him as decent a burial as they could. We would find the new-made grave ahead on Squaw Creek, beyond the crossing, to the right-hand side in a clump of cottonwoods. The next day, while watering the herd at this creek, we all rode over and looked at the grave. The outfit had fixed things up quite nicely. They'd built a square pen of rough cottonwood logs around the grave, and had marked the head and foot with a big flat stone, edged up, heaping up quite a mound of stones to keep the animals away. In a tree his name was cut. Sounded natural, too, though none of us knew him, as Pierce always drove from the East Coast country. There was nothing different about this grave from the hundreds of others which made landmarks on the old Western Trail, except it was the latest. That night around the campfire, some of the boys were moved to tell their experiences. This accident might happen to any of us, and it seemed rather short notice to a man enjoying life, even though his calling was rough. "As for myself," said Rod Wheat, "I'm not going to fret. You can't avoid it when it comes, and every now and then you miss it by a hair. I had an uncle who served 4 years in the Confederate Army, went through 30 engagements, was wounded half a dozen times, came home well and sound. Within a month after his return, a plow handle kicked him in the side, and we buried him within a week." "Oh, well," said Fox, commenting on the sudden call of the man whose grave we had seen, "it won't make much difference to this fellow back there when the horn toots and the graves give up their dead. He might just as well start from there as anywhere. I don't envy him none, though, but if I'd any pity to offer now, it'd be for a mother or sister who might wish that he slept nearer home." This last remark carried our minds far away from their present surroundings to other graves which were not on the trail. There was a long silence. We lay around the campfire and gazed into its depths, while its flickering light threw our shadows out beyond the circle. Our reverie was finally broken by Ash Barrowstone, who was by all odds the most impressionable and emotional one in the outfit. A man who always argued the moral side of every question, yet could not be credited with possessing an iota of moral stamina. Gloomy as we were, he added to our depression by relating a pathetic incident which occurred at a child's funeral when Flood reproved him, saying, "Well, neither that one you mention nor this one of Pierce's men is any of our funeral. We're on the trail with Lovell's cattle. You should keep nearer the earth." There was a long silence after this reproof from the foreman. It was evident there was a gloom settling over the outfit. Our thoughts were ranging wide. At last, Rod Wheat spoke up and said that, in order to get the benefit of all the variations, the blues were not a bad thing to have. But the depression of our spirits was not so easily dismissed. In order to avoid listening to the gloomy tales that were being narrated around the campfire, a number of us got up and went out as if to look up the night horses on picket. The rebel and I pulled our picket pins and changed our horses to fresh grazing, and after lying down among the horses, out of the hearing of the camp, for over an hour, returned to the wagon expecting to retire. A number of the boys were making their beds, as it was already late. But on our arrival at the fire, one of the boys had just concluded a story, as gloomy as the others which had preceded it. "These stories you are all telling tonight," said Flood, "remind me of what Lige Link said to the book agent when he was shearing sheep. 'I reckon,' said Lige, 'that book of yours has a heap sight more poetry in it than there is in shearing sheep. I wish I'd gone on guard tonight, so I could have missed these stories.'" At this juncture, the first guard rode in, having been relieved, and John Officer, who had exchanged places on guard that night with Moss Strayhorn, remarked that the cattle were uneasy. "This outfit," said he, "didn't half water the herd today. One third of them hasn't bedded down yet, and they don't act as if they aim to, either. There's no excuse for it in a well-watered country like this. I'll leave the saddle on my horse, anyhow." "No, that's the result," said our foreman, "of the hour we spent around that grave today, when we ought to have been tending to our job. This outfit," he continued, when Officer returned from picketing his horse. "I've been trying to hold funeral services over that Pierce man's grave back there." "You'd think so, anyway, from the tales they've been telling. I hope you won't get the sniffles and tell any."
"This letting yourselves get gloomy," said Officer, "reminds me of a time we had once at the J.H. camp in the Cherokee Strip. It was near Christmas, and the work was all done up. The boys had blowed their summer wages, and were feeling glum all over. One or two of the boys were lamenting that they hadn't gone home to see the old folks. This gloomy feeling kept spreading until they actually wouldn't speak to each other. One of them would go out and sit on the woodpile for hours, all by himself, and make a new set of good resolutions. Another would go out and sit on the ground, on the sunny side of the corrals, and dig holes in the frozen earth with his knife. They wouldn't come to meals when the cook called them. Now Miller, the foreman, didn't have any sympathy for them. In fact, he delighted to see them in that condition. He hadn't any use for a man who wasn't dead tough under any condition. I've known him to camp his outfit on alkali water, so the men would get out in the morning, and every rascal begged to ride on the outside circle on the morning roundup. Well, 3 days before Christmas, just when things were looking gloomiest, there drifted up from the Cheyenne country one of the old-timers. None of them had seen him in 4 years, though he'd worked on that range before, and with the exception of myself, they all knew him. He was riding the chuck line all right, but Miller gave him a welcome, as he was the real thing. He'd been working out in the Panhandle country, New Mexico, and the devil knows where, since he'd left that range. He was meaty with news and scary stories. The boys would sit around and listen to him yarn, and now and then a smile would come across their faces. Miller was delighted with his guest. He'd shown no signs of letting up at 11 o'clock the first night, when he happened to mention where he was the Christmas before. "There is this little woman at the ranch," said he, "wife of the owner, and I was helping her get up dinner, as we had quite a number of folks at the ranch. She asked me to make the bear sign. Donuts, you know, she called them. And I did, though she had to show me how some little. Well, fellas, you ought to have seen them. Just sweet enough, brown to a turn, and enough to last us a week. All the folks at dinner that day praised them. Since then, I've had a chance to try my hand several times, and you may not tumble to the diversity of all my accomplishments, but I'm an artist on bear sign." And I'll just mention that according to the online cowboy dictionary, bear sign is a cowboy term for donuts made well out on the range. A cook who could and would make them was highly regarded. Miller arose, took him by the hand, and said, "That's straight now, is it?" "That's straight. Making bear sign is my long suit." "Mouse," said Miller to one of the boys, "go out and bring in his saddle from the stable and put it under my bed. Throw his horse in the big pasture in the morning. He stays here until spring. The first spear of green grass I see, his name goes on the payroll. This outfit is shy on men who can make bear sign." "Nah, I was thinking that you could spread down your blankets on the hearth, but you can sleep next to me tonight. You go to work on this specialty of yours right after breakfast in the morning, and show us what you can do along that line." They talked quite a while longer, then turned in for the night. The next morning, after breakfast was over, he got the needed articles together and went to work. But there was a surprise in store for him. There was nearly a dozen men lying around, all able eaters. By 10 o'clock, he began to turn them out as he said he could. When the regular cook had to have the stove to get dinner, the taste which we had had made us ravenous for more. Dinner over, he went at him again in earnest. A boy, riding towards the railroad with an important letter, dropped in, and as he claimed he could only stop for a moment, We stood aside until he had had a taste, though he filled himself up like a poison pup. After eating a solid hour, he filled his pockets and rode away. One of our regular men called after him, "Don't tell anybody what we got." We didn't get any supper that night. Not a man could have eaten a bite. Miller made him knock off along in the shank of the evening, as he had done enough for any one day. The next morning, after breakfast, he fell to at the bear sign once more. Miller rolled a barrel of flour into the kitchen from the storehouse and told him to fly at him. "About how many do you think you'll want?" asked our sign man. "That big tub full won't be too many," answered Miller. "Some of these fellows haven't had any of this kind of truck since they were little boys. If this gets out, I'll look for men from other camps." The fellow fell to his work like a thoroughbred, which he surely was. About 10 o'clock, two men rode up from a camp to the north, which the boy had passed the day before with the letter. They never went near the dugout, but straight to the kitchen. That movement showed that they were on to our racket. An hour later, old Tom Cave rode in, his horse all in a lather, all the way from Garrettson's camp, 25 miles to the east. The old sinner said that he'd been on the frontier some little time, and that these here were the best bear sign he had tasted in 40 year. He refused to take a stool and sit down like civilized folks, but stood up by the tub and picked out the ones which were a pale brown. After dinner, our man threw off his overshirt, unbuttoned his red undershirt, and turned it in until you could see the hair on his breast. Rolling up his sleeves, he flew at his job once more. He was getting his work reduced to a science by this time. He rolled his dough, cut his dough, and turned out the fine brown bear sign to the satisfaction of all. His capacity, however, was limited. About 2 o'clock, Doc Langford and two of his peelers were seen riding up. When he came into the kitchen, Doc swore, by all that was good and holy, that he hadn't heard that our artist had come back to that country. But anyone that was noticing could see him edge around to the tub. It was easy to see that he was lying. This luck of ours was circulating faster than a secret amongst women. Our man, though, stood at his post like the boy on the burning deck. When night came on, he hadn't covered the bottom of the tub. When he knocked off, Doc Langford and his men gobbled up what was left. We gave them a mean look as they rode off, but they came back the next day, 5 strong. Our regular men around camp didn't like it, the way things were going. They tried to act polite, too. "Calling bear sign donuts," interrupted Quince Forrest, "reminds me that..." "Will you kindly hobble your lip," said Officer. "I have the floor at the present. As I was saying, they tried to act polite to company that way, but we hadn't got a smell the second day. Our man showed no signs of fatigue and told several good stories that night. He was tough. The next day was Christmas, but he had no respect for a holiday and made up a large batch of dough before breakfast. It was a good thing he did, for early that morning, Original John Smith and 4 of his peelers rode in from the west, their horses all covered with frost. They must have started at daybreak. It was a good 22-mile ride. They wanted us to believe that they had simply come over to spend Christmas with us. Company that way, you can't say anything negative. But the easy manner in which they gravitated around that tub, not even waiting to be invited, told a different tale. They were not nearly satisfied by noon. Then who should come drifting in as we were sitting down to dinner but Billy Dunlap and Jim Hale from Quinlan's camp, 30 miles south on the Cimarron. Dunlap always holed up like a bear in the winter, and several of the boys spilled their coffee at the sight of him. He put up a thin excuse just like the rest. Anyone could see through it. But there it was again. He was company. Lots of us had eaten at his camp and complained to his chuck. Therefore, we were nice to him. Miller called our man out behind the kitchen and told him to knock off if he wanted to. But he wouldn't do it. He was a clean strain. I'm not talking. Dunlap ate hardly any dinner, we noticed, and the very first batch of bear sign turned out, he loads up a tin plate and goes out and sits behind the storehouse in the sun, all alone in his glory. He satisfied himself out of the tub after that. He and Hale stayed all night, and Dunlap kept everyone awake with the nightmare. Yes, kept fighting the demons all night. The next morning, Miller told him that he was surprised that an old gray-haired man like him didn't know when he had enough, but must gorge himself like some silly kid. Miller told him that he was welcome to stay a week if he wanted to, but he'd have to sleep in the stable. It was cruel to the horses, but the men were entitled to a little sleep, at least in the winter. Miller tempered his remarks with all kindness, and Dunlap acted as if he was sorry, and as good as admitted that his years were telling on him. That day our man filled his tub. He was simply an artist on bear sign.
"Calling bear sign donuts," cut in Quince Forrest again, as soon as he saw an opening. "Reminds me when the little boy said that who went..."
But there came a rumbling of many hoofs from the bed ground.
"There's hell for you," said half a dozen men in a chorus,
and every man in camp ran for his horse but the cook, and he climbed into the wagon. The roar of the running cattle was like approaching thunder, but the flash from the six-shooters of the men on guard indicated they were quartering by camp, heading out toward the hills. Horses became so excited they were difficult to bridle. There was plenty of earnest and sincere swearing done that night. All the fine sentiment and melancholy of the hour previous vanished in a moment as the men threw themselves into their saddles, riding deep, for it was uncertain footing to horses. Within 2 minutes from the time the herd left the bed ground, 14 of us rode on their left point and across their front, firing our six-shooters in their faces. By the time the herd had covered a scant mile, we'd thrown them into a mill. They'd run so compactly that there were no stragglers, so we loosened out and gave them room. But it was a long time before they relaxed any, but continued going round and round like a water wheel or an endless chain. The foreman ordered 3 men on the heaviest horses to split them. The men rode out a short distance to get the required momentum, wheeled their horses, and, wedge-shaped, struck this sea of cattle and entered. But it instantly closed in their wake as though it had been water. For an hour they rode through the herd, back and forth, now from this quarter, now from that, and finally the mill was broken. After midnight, as luck would have it, heavy dark clouds banked in the northwest and lightning flashed, and before a single animal had lain down, a drizzling rain set in. That settled it. It was an all-night job now. We drifted about hither and yon. Horses, men, and cattle turned their backs to the wind and rain and waited for morning. We were so familiar with the signs of coming day that we turned them loose half an hour before dawn, leaving herders, and rode for camp. As we groped our way in that dark hour before dawn, hungry, drenched, and bedraggled, there was nothing gleeful about us, while Bob Blades expressed his disgust over our occupation. "If I ever get home again," said he, and the tones of his voice were an able second to his remarks. "You all can go up the trail that want to, but here's one chicken that won't. There isn't a cowman in Texas who has money enough to hire me again." "Aw, hell now," said Bull. "You oughtn't to let a little rain ruffle your feathers that way. Cheer up, sonny. You might be rich some day yet, and walk on Brussels in velvet." After securing a count on the herd that morning and finding nothing short, we trailed out up the North Platte River. It was an easy country in which to handle a herd. The trail, in places, would run back from the river as far as 10 miles, and again follow close in near the river bottoms. There was an abundance of small creeks putting into this fork of the Platte from the south, which afforded water for the herd and good campgrounds at night. Only twice after leaving Ogallala had we been compelled to go to the river for water for the herd. With the exception of thunderstorms and occasional summer rains, the weather had been all one could wish. For the past week, as we trailed up the North Platte, some of us visited the river daily to note its stage of water, for we were due to cross at 40 Islands, about 12 miles south of old Fort Laramie. The North Platte was very similar to the South Canadian, a wide sandy stream without banks, and our experience with the latter was fresh in our memories. The stage of water had not been favorable, for this river also had its source in the mountains, and as now midsummer was upon us, the season of heavy rainfall on the mountains, augmented by the melting snows, the prospect of finding a fordable stage of water at 40 Islands was not very encouraging. We reached this well-known crossing late in the afternoon in the third day after leaving the Wyoming line, and found one of the Prairie Cattle Company's herds waterbound. This herd had been wintered on one of that company's ranges on the Arkansas River in southern Colorado, and their destination was in the Badlands near the mouth of the Yellowstone, where the same company had a northern range. Flood knew the foreman, Wade Scholar, who reported having been waterbound over a week already, with no prospect of crossing without swimming. Scholar knew the country thoroughly, and had decided to lie over until the river was fordable at 40 Islands, as it was much the easiest crossing on the North Platte, though there was a wagon ferry at Fort Laramie. He returned with Flood to our camp, and the two talked over the prospect of swimming it on the morrow. "Let's send the wagons up to the ferry in the morning," said Flood, "and swim the herds. If you wait until this river falls, you're liable to have an experience like we had on the South Canadian, lost 3 days and bogged over 100 cattle. When one of these sandy rivers has had a big freshet, look out for quicksands. But you know that as well as I do. Why, we've swum over half a dozen rivers already, and I'd much rather swim this one than attempt to ford it just after it has fallen. We can double our outfits and be safely across before noon. I got nearly 1,000 miles yet to make, and have just got to get over. Think it over tonight. Have your wagon ready to start with ours." Scholar rode away without giving our foreman any definite answer as to what he would do. Though earlier in the evening he had offered to throw his herd well out of the way at the ford, and lend us any assistance at his command. But when it came to the question of crossing his own herd, he seemed to dread the idea of swimming the river, and could not be induced to say what he would do, but said that we were welcome to the lead. The next morning, Flood and I accompanied our wagon up to his camp, when it was plainly evident that he did not intend to send his wagon with ours. So McCann started on alone with our chuck wagon, though our foreman renewed his efforts to convince Scholar of the feasibility of swimming the herds. Their cattle were thrown well away from the ford, and Scholar assured us that his outfit would be on hand whenever we were ready to cross, and even invited all hands of us to come to his wagon for dinner. When returning to our herd, Flood told me that Scholar was considered one of the best foremen on the trail, and why he would refuse to swim his cattle was unexplainable. He must have time to burn, but that didn't seem reasonable, for the earlier through cattle were turned loose on their winter range the better. We were in no hurry to cross, as our wagon would be gone all day, and it was nearly high noon when we trailed up to the ford. With the addition to our force of Scholar and 9 or 10 of his men, we had an abundance of help, and put the cattle into the water opposite 2 islands, our saddle horses in the lead as usual. There was no swimming water between the south shore and the first island, though it wet our saddle skirts for some considerable distance, this channel being nearly 200 yards wide. Most of our outfit took the water, while Scholar's men fed our herd in from the south bank, a number of their men coming over as far as the first island. The second island lay down the stream some little distance. As we pushed the cattle off the first one, we were in swimming water in no time, but the saddle horses were already landing on the second island, and our lead cattle struck out and, breasting the water, swam as proudly as swans. The middle channel was nearly 100 yards wide, the greater portion of which was swimming, though the last channel was much wider. But our saddle horses had already taken it, and when within 50 yards of the farther shore, struck solid footing. With our own outfit, we crowded the leaders to keep the chain of cattle unbroken, and before Honeyman could hustle his horse out of the river, our lead cattle had caught a foothold, were heading upstream and edging out on the further shore. I'd one of the best swimming horses in our outfit, and Flood put me in the lead on the point. As my horse came out on the farther bank, I'm certain I never have seen a herd of cattle, before or since, which presented a prettier sight when swimming than ours did that day. There was fully 400 yards of water on the angle by which we crossed, nearly half of which was swimming, but with the two islands which gave them a breathing spell, our circle dots were taking the water as steadily as a herd leaving their bed ground. Scholar and his men were feeding them in, while half a dozen of our men on each island were keeping them moving. Honeyman and I pointed them out of the river, and as they grazed away from the shore, they spread out, fan-like, many of them kicking up their heels after they left the water in healthy enjoyment of their bath. Long before they were half over, the usual shouting had ceased, and we simply sat in our saddles and waited for the long train of cattle to come up and cross. Within less than half an hour from the time our saddle horses entered the North Platte, the tail end of our herd had landed safely on the farther bank. As Honeyman and I were the only ones of our outfit on the north side of the river during the passage, Flood called to us from across the last channel to graze the herd until relieved, when the remainder of the outfit returned to the south side to recover their discarded effects and to get dinner with Scholar's wagon. I'd imitated Honeyman and tied my boots to my cantle strings so that my effects were on the right side of the river. As far as dinner was concerned, well, I'd much rather miss it than swim the Platte twice in its then stage of water. There is a difference in daring in one's duty and in daring out of pure venturesomeness. If we missed our dinners, it would not be the first time, so we were quite willing to make the sacrifice. If the Quirk family never achieved fame for daring by field and flood, until this one of the old man's boys brings the family name into prominence, it will be hopelessly lost to posterity. We allowed the cattle to graze of their own free will and merely turned in the sides and rear. But on reaching the second bottom of the river, where they caught a good breeze, they lay down for their noonday siesta, which relieved us of all work but keeping watch over them. The saddle horses were grazing about in plain view on the first bottom, so Honeyman and I dismounted on a little elevation overlooking our charges. We were expecting the outfit to return promptly after dinner was over, for it was early enough in the day to have trailed 8 to 10 miles farther. It would have been no trouble to send someone up the river to meet our wagon and pilot McCann to the herd, for the trail left on a line due north of the river. We'd been lounging about for an hour while the cattle were resting, when our attention was attracted by our saddle horses in the bottom. They were looking at the ford, to which we supposed their attention had been attracted by the swimming of the outfit, but instead, only two of the boys showed up, and on sighting us nearly a mile away, they rode forward very leisurely. Before their arrival, we recognized them by their horses as Ash Borrowstone and Rod Wheat, and on their riding up, the latter said as he dismounted, Well, they're going to cross the other herd, then they want you to come back and point the cattle with that famous swimming horse of yours. You'll learn after a while not to blow so much about your mount and your cutting horses and your night horses and your swimming horses. I wish every horse of mine had a black brand on him, and I'd ride in the wagon when it comes to swimming these rivers. And I'm not the only one that has a distaste for a wet proposition, for I wouldn't have to guess twice as to what's the matter with Scholar. But Flood has pounded him on the back ever since he met him yesterday evening to swim his cattle, until it's either swim or say he's afraid to. It's shoot Luke or give up the gun with him. Scholar's a nice fella, but I'll bet my interest in goose heaven that I know what's the matter with him. I'm not blaming him either, but I can't understand why our boss should take such an interest in having him swim. It's none of his business if he swims now, fords a month hence, or waits until the river freezes over in the winter and crosses on the ice. We'll let the big augers wrangle it out. You noticed, Ash, that not one of Scholar's outfit ever said a word one way or the other, but Flood poured it on to him until he consented to swim. So, fork that swimming horse of yours and wet your big toe again in the North Platte. As the orders had come from the foreman, there was nothing to do but obey. Honeyman rode as far as the river with me, where after shedding my boots and surplus clothing and secreting them, I rode up above the island and plunged in. I was riding the gray, which I'd dried in the Rio Grande the day we received the herd. Now that I understood handling him better, I preferred him to my speedy black pony, my night horse. We took the first and second islands, with but a blowing spell in between. When I reached the farther shore, I turned in my saddle, and I saw Honeyman wave his hat to me in congratulations. On reaching their wagon, I found the herd was swinging around about a mile out from the river in order to get a straight shoot for the entrance at the ford. I hurriedly swallowed my dinner, and as we rode out to meet the herd, asked Flood if Scholar was not going to send his wagon up to the ferry to cross, for there was as yet no indication of it. Flood replied that Scholar expected to go with the wagon, as he needed some supplies that he thought he could get from the sutler at Fort Laramie. Flood ordered me to take the lower point again. I rode across the trail and took my place when the herd came within a quarter of a mile of the river, while the remainder of the outfit took positions near the lead on the lower side. It was a slightly larger herd than ours, all steers, 3-year-olds that reflected in their glossy coats the benefits of a northern winter. As we came up to the water's edge, it required 2 of their men to force their remuda into the water, though it was much smaller than ours, 6 horses to the man, but better ones than ours, being northern wintered. The cattle were well trail broken and followed the leadership of the saddle horses nicely to the first island, but they would have balked at this second channel had it not been for the amount of help at hand. We lined them out, however, and they breasted the current and landed on the second island. The saddle horses gave some little trouble on leaving for the farther shore, and before they were got off, several hundred head of cattle had landed on the island. But they handled obediently and were soon trailing out upon terra firma, the herd following across without a broken link in the chain. There was nothing now to do but keep the train moving into the water on the south bank, see that they did not congest on the islands, and that they left the river on reaching the farther shore. When the saddle horses reached the farther bank, they were thrown up the river and turned loose, so that the 2 men would be available to hold the herd after it left the water. I had crossed with the first lead cattle to the farther shore, and was turning them up the river as fast as they struck solid footing on that side. But several times I was compelled to swim back to the nearest island and return with large bunches which had hesitated to take the last channel. The 2 outfits were working promiscuously together, and I never knew who was the directing spirit in the work. But when the last 200 or 300 of the tail-enders were leaving the first island for the second, and the men working in the rear started to swim the channel. Amid general hilarity, I recognized a shout that was born of fear and terror. A hushed silence fell over the riotous riders in the river, and I saw those on the sandbar nearest my side rush down the narrow island and plunge back into the middle of the channel. Then it dawned on my mind in a flash that someone had lost his seat, and that terrified cry was for help. I plunged my gray into the river and swam to the first bar, and from thence to the scene of the trouble. Horses and men were drifting with the current down the channel. I appealed to the men, but could get no answer but their blanched faces, though it was plain in every countenance that one of our number was under water, if not drowned. There were not less than 20 horsemen drifting in the middle channel, in the hope that whoever it was would come to the surface and a hand could be stretched out in succor. About 200 yards down the river was an island near the middle of the stream. The current carried us near it. On landing, I learned that the unfortunate man was none other than Wade Scholar, the foreman of the herd. We scattered up and down this middle island and watched every ripple and floating bit of flotsam in the hope that he would come to the surface, but nothing but his hat was seen. In the disorder into which the outfits were thrown by this accident, Flood first regained his thinking faculties and ordered a few of us to cross to either bank and ride down the river and take up positions on the outer islands, from which that part of the river took its name. 100 conjectures were offered as to how it occurred, but no one saw either horse or rider after sinking. A free horse would be hard to drown, and on the non-appearance of Scholar's mount, it was concluded that he must have become entangled in the reins, or that Scholar had clutched them in his death grip, and horse and man thus met death together. It was believed by his own outfit that Scholar had no intention until the last moment to risk swimming the river, but when he saw all the others plunge into the channel, his better judgment was overcome, and rather than remain behind and cause comment, he had followed and lost his life. We patrolled the river until darkness without result, the two herds in the meantime having been so neglected that they had mixed. Our wagon returned along the north bank early in the evening, and Flood ordered Priest to go in and make up a guard from the two outfits and hold the herd for the night. Some of Scholar's outfit went back and moved their wagon up to the crossing, within hailing distance of ours. It was a night of muffled conversation, and every voice of the night or cry of waterfowl in the river sent creepy sensations over us. The long night passed, however, and the sun rose in Sabbath benediction, for it was Sunday, and found groups of men huddled around two wagons in silent contemplation of what the day before had brought. A more broken and disconsolate set of men than Scholar's would be hard to imagine. Flood inquired of their outfit if there was any sub-foreman, or segundo, as they were generally called. It seemed there was not, but their outfit was unanimous that the leadership should fall to a boyhood acquaintance of Scholar's by the name of Campbell, who was generally addressed as Black Jim. Flood at once advised Campbell to send their wagon up to Laramie and cross it, promising that we would lie over that day and make an effort to recover the body of the drowned foreman. Campbell accordingly started his wagon up to the ferry. All the remainder of the outfits, with the exception of a few men on herd, started out in search of the drowned man. Within a mile and a half below the ford, there were located over 30 of the 40 islands, and at the lower end of this chain of sandbars we began and searched both shores, while 3 to 4 men swam to each island and made a vigorous search. The water in the river was not very clear, which called for a close inspection, but with a force of 25 men in the hunt, we covered island and shore rapidly in our search. It was about 8 in the morning, and we'd already searched half of the islands, when Joe Stallings and two of Scholar's men swam to an island in the river which had a growth of small cottonwoods covering it, while on the upper end was a heavy lodgment of driftwood. John Officer, the rebel, and I had taken the next island above, and as we were riding the shallows surrounding it, we heard a shot in our rear that told us the body had been found. As we turned in the direction of the signal, Stallings was standing on a large driftwood log and signaling. We started back to him, partly wading and partly swimming, while from both sides of the river men were swimming their horses for the brushy island. Our squad, on nearing the lower bar, was compelled to swim around the driftwood, and some 12 to 15 men from either shore reached the scene before us. The body was lying face upward, in about 18 inches of eddy water. Flood and Campbell waded out, and taking a lariat, fastened it around his chest under the arms. Then Flood, noticing I was riding my black, asked me to tow the body ashore. Forcing a passage through the driftwood, I took the loose end of the lariat and started for the north bank, the double outfit following. On reaching the shore, the body was carried out of the water by willing hands, and one of our outfit was sent to the wagon for a tarpaulin to be used as a stretcher. Meanwhile, Campbell took possession of the drowned foreman's watch, six-shooter, purse, and papers. The watch was as good as ruined, but the leather holster had shrunk and securely held the gun from being lost in the river. On the arrival of the tarpaulin, the body was laid upon it, and four mounted men, taking the four corners of the sheet, wrapped them on the pommels of their saddles and started for our wagon. When the corpse had been lowered to the ground at our camp, a look of inquiry passed from face to face, which seemed to ask, "What's next?" But the inquiry was answered a moment later by Black Jim Campbell, the friend of the dead man. Memory may have dimmed the lesser details of that Sunday morning on the North Platte, for over 2 decades have since gone, but his words and manliness have lived, not only in my mind, but in the memory of every other survivor of those present. "This accident," said he in perfect composure, as he gazed into the calm, still face of his dear friend, "will impose on me a very sad duty. I expect to meet his mother some day. She will want to know everything. I must tell her the truth, and I'd hate to tell her we buried him like a dog, for she's a Christian woman. And what makes it all the harder, I know that this is the third boy she has lost by drowning. Some of you may not have understood him, but among those papers which you saw me take from his pockets was a letter from his mother, in which she wanted him to guard against just what has happened. Situated as we are, I'm going to ask you all to help me give him the best burial we can. No doubt it will be crude, but it will be some solace to her to know that we did the best we could." Every one of us was eager to lend his assistance. Within 5 minutes, Priest was galloping up the north bank of the river to intercept the wagon at the ferry, a well-filled purse in his pocket with which to secure a coffin at Fort Laramie. Flood and Campbell selected a burial place, and with our wagon spade, a grave was being dug on a nearby grassy mound where there were 2 other graves. There was not a man among us who was hypocrite enough to attempt to conduct a Christian burial service. But when the subject came up, McCann said as he came down the river the evening before, he noticed an emigrant train of about 30 wagons going into camp at a grove about 5 miles up the river. In a conversation which he had had with one of the party, he learned that they expected to rest over Sunday. Their respect for the Sabbath day caused Campbell to suggest that there might be someone in the emigrant camp who could conduct a Christian burial, and he at once mounted his horse and rode away to learn. In preparing the body for its last resting place, we were badly handicapped. but by tearing a new wagon sheet into strips about a foot in width and wrapping the body, we gave it a humble bier in the shade of our wagon, pending the arrival of the coffin. The features were so ashened by having been submerged in the river for over 18 hours that we wrapped the face also, as we preferred to remember him as we had seen him the day before, strong, healthy, and buoyant. During the interim, awaiting the return of Campbell from the emigrant camp and of the wagon, we sat around in groups and discussed the incident. There was a sense of guilt expressed by a number of our outfit over their hasty decision regarding the courage of the dead man. When we understood that two of his brothers had met a similar fate in Red River within the last 5 years, every guilty thought or hasty word spoken came back to us with tenfold weight. Priest and Campbell returned together, the former having secured a coffin which would arrive within an hour, while the latter had met in the emigrant camp a superannuated minister who gladly volunteered his services. He'd given the old minister such data as he had, and two of the minister's granddaughters had expressed a willingness to assist by singing at the burial services. Campbell had set the hour for 4 p.m., and several conveyances would be down from the emigrant camp. The wagon arriving shortly afterwards, we had barely time to lay the corpse in the coffin before the emigrants drove up. The minister was a tall, homely man with a flowing beard, which the frosts of many a winter had whitened, and as he mingled amongst us in the final preparations, he had a kind word for everyone. There were 10 in his party, and when the coffin had been carried out to the grave, the two granddaughters of the old man opened the simple service by singing very impressively the first 3 verses of the Portuguese hymn. I had heard the old hymn sung often before, but the impression of the last verse rang in my ears for days afterward. When through the deep waters I call thee to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow. For I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress. As the notes of the hymn died away, there was for a few moments profound stillness, and not a move was made by anyone. The touching words of the old hymn expressed quite vividly the disaster of the previous day, and awakened in us many memories of home. For a time, we were silent, while eyes unused to weeping filled with tears. I do not know how long we remained so. It may have been only a moment. It probably was. But I do know that the silence was not broken till the aged minister, who stood at the head of the coffin, began his discourse. We stood with uncovered heads during the service, and when the old minister addressed us, he spoke as though he might have been holding family worship and we had been his children. He invoked heaven to comfort and sustain the mother when the news of her son's death reached her, as she would need more than human aid in that hour. He prayed that her faith might not falter, and that she might again meet and be with her loved ones forever in the great beyond. He then took up the subject of life, spoke of its brevity, its many hopes that are never realized, and the disappointments from which no prudence or foresight can shield us. He dwelled at some length on the strange mingling of sunshine and shadow that seemed to belong to every life, on the mystery everywhere, and nowhere more impressively than in ourselves. With his long, bony finger, he pointed to the cold, mute form that lay in the coffin before us and said, "But this, my friends, is the mystery of all mysteries. The fact that life terminated in death," he said, "only emphasized its reality, that the death of our companion was not an accident, though it was sudden and unexpected, that the difficulties of life are such that it would be worse than folly in us to try to meet them in our own strength. Death, he said, might change, but it did not destroy. That the soul still lived and would live forever. That death was simply the gateway out of time into eternity. And if we were to realize the high aim of our being, we could do so by casting our burdens on Him who was able and willing to carry them for us. He spoke feelingly of the great teacher, the lowly Nazarene, who also suffered and died, and he concluded with an eloquent description of the blessed life, the immortality of the soul, and the resurrection of the body. After the discourse was ended, and a brief and earnest prayer was covered, the two young girls sang the hymn, "Shall We Meet Beyond the River?" The services being at an end, the coffin was lowered into the grave. Campbell thanked the old minister and his two granddaughters on their taking leave for their presence and assistance. Then, a number of us boys also shook hands with the old man at parting. And that concludes this section of The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days by Andy Adams. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky. And up the cloudy draw, high air.